Welcome to the Faith Element podcast for the July 9, 2017 session, focusing on Song of Songs, chapter 2, verses 8 through 13, Celebrating Passion. I'm David Cassidy.
I'm Nikki Hardiman.
I'm Bert Montgomery.
And I'm Daniel Glaze.
Bert is back.
Yay!
Yes. I got you back, Bert.
We missed you, man.
Thank you very much. It was a, we had a death in our church of a young child, so it was a tough couple of weeks.
Well, I know they were glad you were there present with them, Bert.
Thank you.
We have an interesting, not just text today, but I mean, rarely do we find ourselves in Song of Songs for a session. But here we are. Yeah. Thankfully, we have Daniel with us, and I know Daniel has some ideas for us in terms of how to embrace this text.
Absolutely, I do, David. And unlike the teenage Daniel Glaze reading Song of Songs, I'll try my best not to giggle nervously throughout this podcast. But before I begin, I'm curious. You know, this Song of Songs is about love. I'd like to ask you all what your favorite love songs are. Maybe our listeners would want to do this in their group study, just as sort of an icebreaker. But as y'all are thinking, I guess I'm more of a classic guy. I love Let's Stay Together by Al Green, but Tina Turner's cover of it is really good.
Yeah.
And because I'm a child of the 80s, Endless Love would be a close second. So how about y'all?
I'm going to go with a classic rock song by Delaney and Body and Friends from the early 70s called Never Ending Song of Love. And then also, obviously, Elvis, Burning Love, Hunka Hunka, Burning Love.
Nice.
Well, I'm going to date myself, but and this song might not normally be, you know, on my favorites list, but Annie's Song by John Denver. And primarily...
Yes.
I mean, it was a song he wrote for his wife.
Yes.
It's got beautiful lyrics, and it was one of my wife's favorite songs, and so we actually had this in our wedding. And so that one is special. But another one that I like, and again, I think the lyrics are very sweet and very powerful, She's Got Away by Billy Joel.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Man, y'all, I have such a hard time picking favorites on anything. I've never been good at it. But when I... thought about it, I grew up listening to country. I was raised on country music. And so Trish Yearwood, She's in Love with a Boy, was always a favorite of mine when I was a teenager to sing. But then I thought about Sonny and Cher, I've Got You, Babe. And then I realized,
all right,
most of mine are like me and whoever against the world. So maybe I should think about that.
Nice. Well, so that wasn't just purely an icebreaker. I did have a point. And, you know, we talk so easily about songs about romantic love. We write poems about love. We watch movies about love. But when romantic love appears in Scripture, we lose our ever-loving minds.
So true.
Why is that? True, this book of the Bible doesn't mention God. It doesn't teach us how to serve the poor or what the kingdom of heaven is like, but it does give us a picture of two people creatively expressing the love God has given to them. So why do we have this visceral reaction to this passage? Is it because at first glance we consider love and romance and sex to be somehow taboo or dirty and not at all related to our spirituality? Perhaps. But we know that's not true because God created us, every part of us, including our capacity for making and showing love. Maybe we struggle to hear the Scripture because of all its rural, pastoral, nature-inspired language. Images of gazelles or flowers or a turtle dove or vines in blossom are meant to invoke passion. But for those of us who live in urban areas, or at least in town, we don't recognize the romance of country life. Because, well, our idea of the rustic life is planting a few tomatoes or herbs in a corner of the backyard. I suspect that when the writer speaks of fruitful trees and blossoming vines giving forth fragrance, these are sensual images, symbolic of love and romance, but I think we often miss that. I wonder if we have trouble with this section because here we have a female speaking sensually and romantically to her lover. I don't need to tell you that we live in a culture that expects females to suppress their sexuality. Male virility is often expressed as strength, while female sexual expression is seen as dirty and sinful. But the testimony of Song of Songs is that the expression of love is mutual. The narrator of today's passage is a female speaking of her male lover. And just beyond today's passage, we read, "My beloved is mine and I am his." This mutuality is almost elliptical in nature. I am his, he is mine. It reminds me of those couples so dearly in love that it's difficult to think of one without thinking of the other. Whatever our difficulties in hearing this passage, it's time to get over them. Ultimately, the Bible is the story of God and humanity. So why should we be surprised to find biblical stories of God's children exploring one of God's great gifts? So let's all just relax a little bit, take a deep breath, and let's talk about what Song of Songs has to teach us.
Daniel, that's a great introduction. And I love your reference to, you know, teenage Daniel and teenage all of us, right? Would kind of giggle ridiculously whenever this comes up. It's the same kind of giggle when we sing Away in a Manger at Christmas and we get to that one verse that has that one word that you're not supposed to say, but we get to sing it in a hymn. Go look up Away in a Manger. You can all find it. Or wait, maybe it wasn't Away in a Manger. Maybe it's another Christmas hymn. But, you know, nobody ever said that the Bible was G-rated. And there's plenty of things in Scripture that cause us to talk about things that are not a part of normal conversation. But it can often help us if we think about where the texts come from. So Song of Songs is a part of a group of texts that were entered into Hebrew scripture as wisdom literature. So when we understand a little bit about wisdom literature, it can help us know how to approach this text. And so wisdom literature, the intent was not so much to say something about who God is, the way that we find in most of the rest of scripture, but rather wisdom literature is trying to show us something about how to live. So if you think of Proverbs or Job is also wisdom literature. Some of the Psalms are, Ecclesiastes. It is either by instruction or by example, trying to hold up for us a picture of what it looks like to live in the way God has called us to live. And so when I think about it that way, I am encouraged that this then is a picture of what romantic love might look like for us. And I think that that can help us as we consider all of what we find in this particular book and in this particular passage.
I mean, Nikki, I think you're absolutely right that the scriptures are remarkably human. I mean, we find every aspect of humanity expressed in the scriptures.
Right.
We may not want to focus always on those, right?
Right,
but I mean,
right.
We've got every manner of crime and violence and injustice, and I mean, it's rough stuff. And you know, maybe we have taken too careful approach to scripture. You know, maybe it's because it reveals so much of our humanity that we are cautious about it. I don't know, but I guess I do wonder if the churches, you know, I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, we obviously are expressing some awkwardness around this text.
Sure.
With our middle school comments. not that middle schoolers are any problem. I like middle schoolers. Anyway, but, but you know, the fact that there's this list of things that the church sometimes has trouble having conversation around.
Right.
I think that's something we ought to, as a church, begin to deal with, because I think we live in a world that's ready for the church to speak a word to these issues.
Well, and I think that it is a good thing that we tread lightly when talking about romantic relationships inside of the church. And that you know, that private things we help keep private. But I think that within the church, we have gone too far. And when we don't offer some kind of word on what makes a healthy relationship between two people who are in love, then we end up creating the space that unhealthy relationships grow and develop, right? When we don't learn how to celebrate the gifts of a physical relationship with someone else, then we don't instruct people on what's not good and what's unhealthy and what's harmful. Mm-hmm. And so we end up in a culture that celebrates sexuality as a commodity rather than as something of who we are and as something that is intrinsic to what it means to be human. And I also think that when we don't instruct people on, when we don't offer a picture of what makes a healthy, good physical relationship, then we make room for violence to show up in those relationships and people who are not empowered to respond to that in healthy ways. And so our discomfort in talking about sexuality can breed unhealth in those areas of our lives in our relationships. Quick note, I was doing a prayer circle one time at a group, and so I had prayer stations. So we had all these stations set up all over the room, and each one dealt with something different. And one of them was to pray for acts of violence that were happening around the world. And in one of those places, I instructed the people to pray for people who suffered at the hands of sexual violence and gave some statistics and asked people to pray. And everyone became very uncomfortable because of that word. The word was used. And so mm-hmm. there was this sense that we couldn't even talk about these things that really could use the help of the church speaking a word to it because of our discomfort with the topic. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, yes. It does, Nikki. And I think you're right on that. When we don't exhibit a positive ethic here, I think we contribute not only to the negative manifestations of romantic love or what mm-hmm. is what passes for that, but you know, if we say, you know what, this talk just isn't appropriate in a community of faith, then what is someone to do if he or she experiences abuse?
Right.
Well, then, mm-hmm. you know, if we can't talk about it at all, then, you know, if I'm hurting here, I can't share that in my congregation.
Right.
And we build on, you know, this culture of silence,
mm-hmm.
Which I think is another form of violence.
Yeah.
And,
yes.
And is it too strong to say re-victimizes
Absolutely.
Victims by saying this, you cannot express mm-hmm. this here.
Right. Right. So then the church becomes complicit.
Yeah, I think so.
But, you know.
Yeah.
Well, and psychologically, in our repression, it's not just outward violence or complicit, but the lack of willingness to affirm, to recognize, acknowledge, and affirm the goodness of our mm-hmm. sexual nature leads us. I mean, so you know, the whole psychological dimension of repression, these are powerful human urges that are going to find their way out. And more often than not, you know, in very negative, harmful ways to ourselves and to others, if we're not taught and not raised and not allowed to acknowledge that they exist. Mm. And then comes, you know, when they've acted out in negative ways, then comes the shaming and the silence and the don't tell anybody. But that doesn't do anything to stop it.
Right. Right. And let's be honest, if we don't have positive examples, people learn about this one way or another, you know, whether it's on the school playground or when they're searching on the internet or in I almost said magazines, but people really don't learn from magazines anymore, do they? There's plenty on the internet. But people are going to form their own opinions and about what is good and healthy and helpful, but without guidance Our world gives a very different picture of what really is good and healthy and helpful in these kinds of relationships.
I absolutely agree. And that's why I think, while I certainly am respectful of those who may not choose to study this passage for this coming Sunday, or those may want to concentrate elsewhere, I think Song of Songs may be a place where we can talk about positive attributes of romantic love, where one person isn't abused or dominated, but where there's a sense of mutuality, and particularly this passage where the female gives voice to her own feelings about her lover. Mm-hmm. If our listeners and if our small groups can trust one another enough to have this discussion, I almost see this as a great way to begin that process, starting right here.
Daniel, I'm so glad you picked up on that this is the female voice in the text. It is so rare that we hear female voices in Scripture. Generally, it's a part of a narrative, but rarely is a female the author of biblical texts. And so these are her words. Now she is repeating the words of her lover back to him, remembering what he said and what it called forth from her. But I do think that we are in a culture where female sexuality is used to take power away from women. It's used to shame them. It's used to put women in boxes where either you fit in like the purity box or the not so pure box. This shows a woman who is embracing that part of herself in a very powerful way. And it is celebrated in biblical scripture as a good thing. And that's powerful. It is not something that we teach in our churches.
Well, I'm wondering. This is one of those few books that are very controversial. One of the reasons why we don't talk about it very much. And if you really wonder, why did this get into our canon, in our biblical canon? Why is it here? How did it get here? And when you study the history of the formation of our Bible, you realize it was pretty controversial back then, because I think, as Daniel mentioned in his intro, there's no mention of God at all. And actually, the rabbis were arguing about it. From some of the scholarship that I've read, rabbis argued about this all the time and finally decided, well, we could decide it's an allegory. It's an allegory of God's love for humanity, right? And so try to take... Even though it does so in the context of human sexual fulfillment and pleasure within lovers, we could somehow back out of that a little bit and say, this is the type of relationship God has with us. And so that helped kind of, okay, we can accept that. And that kind of eased the tension a little bit and got it into the canon. But nevertheless, even at that level, you're still using the human emotions and physical responses of romance and love and passion that you're sharing with one another in its purest form, and saying, this is what our relationship with God is like. Christian mystics throughout the ages, Jewish mystics as well, have long used sexual and erotic imagery as talking about, to describe the intimacy of a relationship with a loving God. So, we need to keep that context, because if we want to talk about it as this is God's relationship with us, well, you're using things that we will be aware of, if we're not yet, we will be soon as we get older, right? For teenagers listening, in the proper context. but very powerful human emotions and physical urges are being used and described in very holy ways. So we could look at this both on the context of a healthy relationship between two adults, but then also knowing these things and saying, this is the kind of intimacy God seeks from us. Mm. And this is the kind of intimacy we can have with God. And if we're very hesitant or negative or dirty or whatever with this context, how does that affect our understanding and relationship with God?
And I think we have to recognize that your point is well taken, Bert, that sometimes we draw the world into these sections, right? There's this spiritual realm that's good and perfect, and there's this physical realm that's imperfect and dirty. Mm. And that harkens all the way back. Oh, here's the philosopher in me. But I mean, that goes all the way back to Plato, the ancient Greek philosopher, who really gave us this context, this worldview that was very dualistic, and put the good things in the spirit realm, in the realm of ideas, and put the bad things in the realm of the physical. But as Christians, I don't know how we read the scriptures and play that dualistic game, because we have a God that chose to come be among us as one of us in full physical form, not just looking like a person, but coming as a human. That's not possible, right? I mean, how can you be in a physical realm, in a physical body, if that's a bad place to be?
Right.
Does that make sense? I mean, I think the incarnation itself is it's the ultimate expression of love. And when we talk about physical love in a committed relationship, we are talking about two people who share of themselves completely, right? Mm-hmm. All that we are, our heart, our mind, our bodies. And we see that example in God through this gift of the incarnation. God fully gave to be one with us.
Yeah, Bernard of Clairvaux, the Christian mystic from around 1100, talks about that. That the Song of Psalms gets to the point that we're not using words. We're physically, emotionally, intimately connected with another person. Love songs could only say so much, right? And that at some point or another, the love of God goes beyond words, and it's an intimate love connection. If I may reference a really bad game show from the 70s, but that was a game, Love Connection.
I've been listening to you talk for the last few minutes, and the word that keeps coming up is intimacy. I think that if we are really honest, the reason that talking about sexuality with one another is uncomfortable is because what we're really talking about is intimacy and vulnerability. We show sexuality on the TV all day long, right? But it lacks intimacy. And if you ever come across a scene in a movie that really truly expresses that intimacy, it is uncomfortable to watch two other people experience that kind of closeness and nearness. And so I think that if you are leading this lesson this week and talking with your group about it, that talking about what real intimacy is, the risks that it poses when we allow ourselves to be intimate with another person emotionally, spiritually, physically, before we're ready, or before that relationship is ready, how that can be harmful, but also kind of the joy that comes when you can be that close to another person. Or if you're going to move along this traditional interpretation of Song of Songs as showing us what it can be like to be in relationship with God that way, what that kind of intimacy with God is really like, I think that we get to the heart of the passage and what the point of it is, because the discomfort isn't just the physical alone, right? It is that is an entryway into this intimate connection that we can have with another person. And that is the private, uncomfortable, not sure what to do with peace that I think we're talking about here.
Andrew Greeley says that the Song of Songs is not allegorical, but it is sacramental.
Mm.
He says that human passion gives us a hint, just a hint, of God's passion for us. We are most like God's love for us. We are most like God's love for us when we are aroused in the presence of our beloved. And we best experience a hint of God's love when our beloved pursues us.
Well, thank you all for a intimate conversation about a text that calls us to be aware of a part of our createdness that we may sometimes not want to pay attention to in the church. Thanks for helping us have that conversation today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Y'all have a good night.
Faith Element is a service of Faith Lab.